Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention. And his latest book is Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And what was your impression of President Obama's new foreign policy vision outlined at West Point?
Well, I thought Alistair Crook's appraisal was quite eloquent and elegant. I think Obama was trying to do very much what Mr. Crook outlined, dispel the old myths of the Cold War. He has been, as Crook put it, on his back foot, somewhat defensive about that. I think he is dealing with a world that's changing very rapidly, that is indeed anti-system. He's dealing with a Russian mentality of revisionism, of what they thought was a somewhat brutal and unfair, just Cold War peace. I agree with him that Obama does have this relationship with Putin, as he does with some other leaders in the world, that is somewhat furtive and covert, certainly hidden from much of Washington or the mainstream media. I would disagree with one characterization, which was that this all comes from the team of rivals. It's true that Obama talked a lot about that book and had read it when he began to form his government. But what in fact happened was really quite different. President Lincoln brought together the most eminent figures of the Republican Party, some of the old Whigs, people like William Seward, who were exceptional figures in American politics, very much Lincoln's intellectual equals, and in some respects, certainly his cultural and class betters. That was not the case with Barack Obama. Hillary Clinton could not be confused as his intellectual better. And many of the culprits that Mr. Crook is identifying here, the neocons who came into the Obama administration, were allowed to either continue in positions of authority that they'd enjoyed under the Bush regime, or were given new responsibilities, what could hardly be in the same category. You know, my characterization of the speech, Ian, is that there is not very much here that was new if one has been following what the president has been saying or trying to say in press conferences or in other speeches. I hate to be pedestrian and provincial here after Alistair Crook's elegant presentation, but as we used to say in New Mexico, I think the president in this case is all hat and no cattle, meaning that there's not very much substance beyond the rather noble expression that he is quite good at. Yes, of course, he's had a relationship with Putin. We've seen the benefits of that, as Alistair Crook pointed out, in Syria, to some extent in Iran already, and certainly in the restraint of Moscow in the Crimea. That's been quite beneficial for him. But we have also seen the cost to the price of having within your own ranks this built-in opposition, and that's been manifest, of course, in the ascendancy of the Pentagon and the military in Afghanistan, the continuing impotence in dealing with the Egyptian tyranny, the veritable military takeover and coup there, and obviously also in the Ukraine, where Obama was a victim, very much, I think, of a covert action and a bureaucratic rebellion within his own party, within his own ranks. This is all, you and I have talked about this before, this is all the result of having assembled to begin with a very weak and vulnerable White House staff. If you're going to oppose a rival like Hillary Clinton, whose politics are all too clear in the State Department, if you're going to keep Bob Gates in the Pentagon and try to do something about the dominance of American foreign policy by the military and by this huge glandular intelligence establishment that built up in the Bush years, if you're going to do all that, you have to have more than Jim Jones or Tom Donilon or McDonough or Rhodes or the sort of second and third rate people that that he assembled around him. Some of those, Samantha Power and Susan Rice, for that matter, even opposed him in the Libyan bombing, which is, as we all know, has turned into a rather sour and tragic sequel. On the other hand, this did not, and I think this is one of the ironies of the Obama administration, this did not necessarily lead to some kind of ascendance of diplomacy or of a new foreign policy. I call Hillary Clinton frequent flyer because I think she did not much more than flit around the world. She did nothing to reform that institution or to repair its loss of prestige and power to the Pentagon and to the CIA. Into the intelligence community in general. It's an irony. I think John Kerry is doing, ironically, another subject, doing more vis-a-vis the Pentagon and Chuck Hagel than she ever did with Bob Gates. The speech, I thought, was pedestrian to a large extent. One thing struck me. One of the decided ovations he got was when he said to this graduating class of Army second lieutenants, you're going to be the first class in a very long time that'll be graduating out into a world where you're not going to be automatically sent to a theater of war. And they were quite happy to hear that. The unspoken side of that is that this will quite possibly be the single most powerful graduating class of West Point in the history of the Academy. And by that I mean they will inherit a system in which the military tail wags the dog from the Middle East through Africa into Central Asia. They will dominate the special operations that really shapes so much of American foreign policy. They will make the policy choices that will determine how the drones are used. This is going to be an extraordinarily powerful generation of young officers. We can only hope to God they are better educated than their predecessors. But this was, I think, Obama at his best and at the same time at his worst. He was not very candid, after all, about what the real choices are, what the real crisis is in the Ukraine. Didn't talk at all about the history, the tragic history that Alistair Crook did refer to, how much America is responsible for this attitude, both in the Kremlin and the facts on the ground. So, and it has been, as you have so well pointed out in past programs, very misrepresented, if not totally distorted, by the American media.
And again, I'm speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention. And his latest book is Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. So how does Obama deal with this contradiction that the American public is fed up with intervention, but they like being the world's leading superpower, and he's up against a foreign policy establishment and press that are very hawkish and full of cold warriors, and he's got constant sniping from Senator John McCain, who I think he pointed out in his talk at West Point. Obama suggested, you know, that they see negotiation as weakness, and I would add to that they see bombing as strength. But the irony, of course, is throughout all of the, given that the deck is stacked against Obama, who's apparently quietly trying to stop a catastrophe from happening, the American people are largely on his side, even those that don't support him.
Well, I disagree with Alistair Crook that there is quite so much pressure on this president. I know there seems to be inside the Beltway in particular, and the Democrats are facing a midterm election. But we know from all of the polls that foreign policy is well down the list of crucial issues in that election. The president's perceived weakness vis-a-vis the Russians or anybody else in the world is not a compelling issue for people who are still suffering a sluggish, if not failed, recovery, for people who are still very, very uncertain about the future and the future of their children. I mean, domestic issues are going to be the by far, I think, the most decisive in the 2016 election. and in the 2014 before. So that I don't think the Democrats face a foreign policy referendum on Obama's policies anytime soon. And I think the pressure is as much as you let it be. The Beltway media and all the rest, I think, have been doing what they always do. It's quite predictable. And the president has been doing, let's face it, what he always does, which is to deflect this with a certain aplomb. He deals very well in this world of rhetoric and of as the sometime constitutional law professor lecturing his audience. He has kept the lid on the worst of this. I think he needs much better and stronger people immediately around him. You know, I watched very, very intimately, Ian, a president named Richard Nixon oppose almost all of his own government, and certainly the old democratically dominated bureaucracy. And he did it by having someone as ruthless and as brilliant and as power-hungry as Henry Kissinger at his side. It's not impossible for presidents to run, in effect, a kind of de facto dictatorship in foreign policy if they're skillful enough, if they're political enough, and if they understand how policy is made. But the most distressing thing about Obama, and I think it's been there from the very beginning, is that there's a kind of overweening arrogance and, I think, at the same time, a haunting ignorance in the man about how policy is actually made. What happened in the Ukraine was a matter of all of these officially funded, government-funded programs, some covert, some overt, really off the reservation, and not functioning within what the White House understood to be presidential policy, but doing the bidding of Victoria Nuland and the neocons who are left within the government. Until January 20th, 2017, assuming that Hillary Clinton is the heiress here, Barack Obama will be the chief executive of the United States. He will have enormous power if he understands finally, at long last, where the levers of power are and how to use them. And if he continues to make his case steadfastly and continues to resist what is, for the most part, a kind of fading pressure on Iran, if he continues to get the kind of cooperation that he has gotten so far from Tehran, from Rouhani, and from Putin in Moscow, then I think he's going to make it. I agree with Alistair Crook that we're living in a very precarious age of financial interdependence, that the United States is very vulnerable to a cyber attack. The financial system, we know, can come crashing down around us. But it's almost akin to a system you know very well from your study called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction, which we had in the nuclear age with the nuclear standoff with the Soviet Union. No power can institute this exchange, can begin this kind of warfare without suffering, really, in the end, unacceptable damage themselves. So this was a myth, incidentally, of pre-World War I Europe, that the economies of the old Europe, and certainly the British and the Germans and the French, and even the Russians to some extent, were so intertwined that they could not afford to go to war. Now, that certainly was not true in 1914, but it is much more true in 2014, and that very interdependence, I think, is maybe our very best hope.
Well, you mentioned how Nixon and Kissinger were able to control and do an end run around the bureaucracy. When you mentioned that, I thought, and you could add to that, and Vice President Cheney also was a great exemplar of
that. Oh, absolutely. And you know, I mean, Alistair Crook was saying, well, when you have papers going here and not going there, and you have, there's lots of examples of this, of course, in Whitehall and Downing Street, you do have dysfunctional government. government and dysfunctional systems. My goodness, the Nixon administration was broadly dysfunctional in terms of the bureaucracy and suffered its own Snowden cases, its own defections, and the Pentagon Papers crisis, and ultimately the crisis of extra constitutional acts that brought it down. But for the most part, Kissinger and Nixon function as a kind of diarchy, as a kind of co-ruled regime, the Hindenburg and Ludendorff, I used to call them, of American politics, and they simply did what they thought they ought to do and needed to do, and thus the opening to China, thus the SALT Treaty that was done against much of the advice of the Pentagon. They emasculated the Department of State. They simply ignored the CIA, thus the atrocities that took place in much of the world, in Chile and in Bangladesh, and the atrocity of the continuing war in Vietnam. But no one at the end of the process was ever confused about who was actually calling the shots and who was actually running foreign policy. I think Barack Obama will look back in his memoirs with some regret about not only those appointments, I hope, but also about how much he did not understand, how much he did not come to grips with the actual functioning of the U.S. government.
But it seems to me that what I was struck by what Alistair Crook was saying is that we are at a very important state of flux here, that it could go one way or the other, that even what's happened so far in Ukraine may well have driven Putin and China together. I know they've been negotiating that gas deal for decades, but the idea that you could push Russia and China together, that they could form an alternative financial system, and that there's still pressure on Obama to use the so-called financial neutron bomb, the Scarlet Letter, which apparently is, and I believe this to be the case, America's most powerful weapon. It's the power of our control over the international financial system. You pull that trigger once, it's all over. So I think we're at a critical stage, aren't we?
Well, I think we are, Ian, but as I said earlier, the assured destruction is mutual. I think no one mistakes that at this point. I do think there will be pressure on all sides, but I think we're going to get he's going to get some help from the Iranians, and I think that there obviously are limiting factors here in Moscow. Putin wants and will deal with the Crimea. I think what he wants out of the Ukraine is a face-saving device that will not cost him too dearly, but will keep his new and growing power at home more or less intact. I think he does want to deal with this new government. He does undoubtedly see it as an American creature, but what else is new? I mean, he's dealing all along his old border there with American creatures of one kind or another. You know, the history of Russian restraint in crises like this, even crises that have a more dire implication for power in Moscow, the history of Russian restraint is sort of encouraging. Gorbachev did not, we should remember, call in the troops when the Baltic states were going. He did not call in the troops when it was clear that Poland and East Germany were teetering. And it was that decision to cede the political space to the West or to the reformist elements in the old satellites that saved us from a kind of terminal crisis in the Cold War. It's not often talked about, but it was an act of true statesmanship, and it came from the Kremlin. And there certainly were elements in the Russian military, as there in the Soviet military then, as there are in the Russian military now, that wanted a confrontation of one sort or to one degree or another with the West. But I think that our best bet here, honestly, is that Obama continue what is his specialty as a rather phlegmatic and poised political creature, if not as an administrator of a government, but as a political creature, and that he can keep the lid on. At least we can hope for that.
So you don't see the idea of a sort of axis organized against the United States, China, Iran, and Russia.
Oh, I absolutely I do, but I don't think that's a result of anything that's happened in the last 20 minutes or the last 20 months. That's been forming for a very, very long time. The unipolar world that emerged with the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the old Soviet Union, the seeming preeminence of American power, which then went on to strut its stuff and to suffer its comeuppance so ignominiously in Iraq and Afghanistan. All of that is a long-term development. Of course, the Russians and the Chinese will collaborate and will learn to come together. But there are restraining factors on all sides. The Chinese are still very much in search of a regional power role, not a global one. The Chinese have no stake in some kind of global confrontation in business, financial terms, least of all, certainly not in military terms. I think there are real restraints operating in Beijing. The Russians, God knows, have got their economic problems, and yes, they're a gifted people, and yes, they could hurt us a great deal in any kind of economic or cyber confrontation. But I think their stake in peace and their stake in realizing the traditional role of Eastern Europe and the borderlands as a buffer, as an area of their influence and domination, will appease a lot of that. I mean, I just think that there are some positive developments here, and in a sense, the most positive is the one that you pointed out, which is that Obama seems to have nobody or very few people inside the Beltway on his side, and a decided majority outside who are in his corner. And he doesn't even need their active support. He needs their neutrality. He needs them to be absent from the debate. And I think they will be very largely. They will absent themselves in 2014 in November and again in 2016 because they're going to be preoccupied, as I think they probably should be, with the tragedy of their own domestic economic mess.
And meanwhile, of course, the anti-system uprising and popular rejection of elites in Europe and the Middle East and here in the United States will continue. And that's
will continue, and that's another very, very hopeful development. I think that's happening faster and more widely than we might have suspected some time ago. God knows Obama has not really contributed very much to that. He is, as Alistair Crook said, sort of trying to navigate the current here, trying to the rapids of whitewater, which is what he's writing. But that's happening everywhere, and it's bound to be reflected sooner or later in the electoral politics of the Europeans. And I do think this fascist craze is a passing thing in Europe, the turn right. And I do think that it's going to be reflected sooner or later in Russian politics as well. If I had to pick, this may sound crazy, if I had to pick who would be the most enduring political symbols of this era 30 or 40 or 50 years from now, I would say that Pussy Riot will be every bit as important as Vladimir Putin.
Well, Roger Morris, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, and his latest book is Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.